in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, June 9th, 2014, and I made it into the new office. Here I am in my new office. And just to give you a sense of the luxury in which I'm indulging here, I now have an office with a window. How about that? Now I have some sense of how the other half lives. I'm sitting here looking out my window. Oh my goodness. Who knew? You know, I never could have dreamed that I could have such an office. But here I am in my office with a window, indeed. What I do not have just yet and won't have till this afternoon is the internet in this office. So I've got this program. I'm getting it ready. And I'm going to get in the car and pretty much drive to McDonald's and sit in the parking lot and upload it to my producer so we can get it up there for you guys. And then things should be normal by this afternoon. Today we're going to talk to Dan Simmons, who is a chief policy expert and the director of regulatory and state affairs at the Institute for Energy Research. InstituteForEnergyResearch.org is their website. We're going to talk today about so-called fracking or hydraulic fracturing. I've had some requests for a conversation on this, and our old friend Bob Murphy, who will be our guest on this program tomorrow, by the way, if my memory of our schedule serves, Bob recommended Dan Simmons. So I'm very glad right now to welcome Dan to the program. Dan Simmons, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Can you explain for the layman what fracking is?
Sure. Fracking is it's a shortened form of hydraulic fracturing. It's one of probably it's an example of that the oil industry is run by engineers and not PR people, because this technology that has fundamentally transformed oil and natural gas generation in the U.S. Has a pretty bad description. So what hydraulic fracturing is that there are deposits of oil and natural gas that are locked in shale rock. That is, I mean, it is literally rock. But there's oil and natural gas in it. Much of that is thousands of feet below the ground. And what happens is that oil companies they drill down, and then the technology that is really change the way that we go after this stuff is that they're then able to drill horizontally. Now, exactly how you go from drilling vertically to horizontally, I don't understand. But because the rocks are laid, more or less horizontally, they can drill along horizontally. And then they pump water down. They let off small explosions to create some fissures in the rock, and then they pump water and some chemicals at a very high pressure. Then what that does is it further fractures the rock, and that's the hydraulic fracturing. And then when they withdraw it, up comes the oil, up comes natural gas out of what in the past has been, I mean, people have known that there's oil and gas there, but they've been unable to extract it until they figured out the creating small fissures and then, water at very high temperature to really expand those fissures and to allow the oil and gas to escape. So in a nutshell, that is hydraulic fracturing.
Now, this is a relatively recent technology, am I right?
Well, not exactly. Like the actual technology of hydraulic fracturing has been around since the late 40s. What has changed is the combination of hydraulic fracturing with the directional drilling, so that they can go horizontally. Because if you're just going vertically, you're able to fracture just a small section of area. Since you're punching a hole, it's like you're punching a hole through a you know, the difference between, like, imagine if a shale formation is like a 2x4. If you just go vertically through it, that's what an inch and a half or whatever a 2x4 actually measures. But what they're able to do is to drill into it and then go horizontally along the whole thing, you know, along your whole, you know, the whole length, you know, 8-foot length, and then fracture the entire thing. And so it's much greater surface area. So it's the hydraulic fracturing, which is 60 years old, combined with directional drilling, which is much newer, you know, about 20 years old, as I understand it. And then the third part is digital imaging. And it, you know, using seismic, you know, smaller explosions, and then, you know, very accurate listening devices and then supercomputers to figure out, you know, where the stuff is that they actually want to get at. Those three technologies together is what has created the boom of oil and gas production. So, but, you know, people just call it fracking, but it's really, you know, really three technologies all together what has created this oil and gas boom.
Okay, I understand now. Thanks. Now, put this in perspective for us, what the significance of this development is, the combination of these three things. What is the significance of this in terms of, I mean, you've mentioned that there's a boom, energy boom going on right now, but can you put some numbers on this in terms of what this means for energy consumption, energy supplies today as compared to before this was going on?
Sure. The U.S. was, you know, for 30 to 40 years, our natural gas production was more or less flat. Back in the mid-2000s, there was a lot of talk about how we need to start importing natural gas because, you know, our natural gas consumption continued to increase, and natural gas prices had been rather volatile. And then with oil production, our oil production had fallen since the early 1970s. And those two things have completely changed. In the last 5 years, our natural gas production is up about 20%. Our oil production is up, as in U.S. as a whole, our oil production is up nearly 50% over the last 5 years. And that's all due to this technology. For years, for decades, people have known that these formations contain a lot of oil, but there's just been no cost-effective way of getting it. And so that is the, you know, the U.S. is currently the world's largest producer of natural gas. In fact, we produce more natural gas than the entire Middle East combined. And by next year, we'll probably be the largest producer of oil in the world. So, I mean, it's a very big deal, especially when you look at the historic trend of declining oil production, and now we have reversed that.
Now, on the other hand, critics will say, for example, people who support the peak oil theory will say that, on the other hand, as remarkable as this technology is, it still is, although we say cost-effective, it still is relatively expensive, and so we shouldn't be under the impression that cheap and abundant energy is here. It may be abundant, but it's not cheap. What do you say to that?
Well, one, it depends on your definition of cheap. Yes, I would prefer that oil cost $20 a barrel instead of $100 a barrel. But at $100 a barrel, or $80 a barrel, or probably even $60 a barrel, it means that we're able to produce a lot more in the U.S. than previously. Because, I mean, it is a heck of a lot cheaper to just punch a hole in the ground and to suck up, you know, up from the ground comes a bubbling crude kind of oil. But, you know, that in the U.S., we don't have nearly as many of those deposits as we used to, or we don't necessarily know about them. We have quite a lot of conventional oil still. What matters is, you know, relative prices. And that's the most important thing, because this oil is, you know, at the current state of affairs in the world, this oil is cost effective. Yes, it would be great if it were cheaper, but, you know, it's not. It's reality.
What about peak oil? How does this process that you're describing affect the peak oil thesis, if at all?
What it does is it. I mean, my problem with peak oil has always been that peak oilers don't really understand substitutes. One of the problems with peak oil is that they assume that we're going to run out of oil, and you know, they have a point in that. But we might not always have this always very easy to get to oil, but what happens over time is technological improvement opens up vast, you know, vast resources that we didn't even consider a few years ago, and that's what's happened with that's what's happened with hydraulic fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing, you know, the estimates of the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania about what was recoverable 10, 15 years ago compared to what is recoverable today have increased by 40 times, and that's the same thing for the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. And, you know, this is the thing about hydraulic fracturing is it's an American success story, but sadly, it's so far, it's only pretty much been American. If you're able to export this technology around the world, and there are some challenges to doing that, namely property rights is one of the biggest ones, then, you know, to have more, you know, what if you want to call it democratization of oil production of countries of the world, that means that there will be much, much more oil production and not just in the United States.
Now, let's say a little something about property rights, because some people, critics of so-called fracking, have said that the process may yield you more fossil fuels, but at a substantial cost. That, for example, they cite cases of leakages of harmful chemicals into groundwater. They say that air and water pollution is a natural consequence of the process. They say that landscapes are ruined and all kinds of aspects of the physical environment that we all enjoy are damaged or threatened by this process. So what, if anything, is true about that?
What is true is there isn't a, you know, from hydraulic fracturing, there isn't a single confirmed case of groundwater contamination from the hydraulic fracturing portion itself. You know, there are a lot of wells that have been drilled in the U.S. of oil and gas wells, and not all wells are created equal. There have been some contamination of groundwater from, you know, from oil and gas drilling generally, because, you know, what matters is the casing. Now, the good news is that the, you know, as time progresses, that they have done, the oil and gas industry has done a much better job of improving their casing so that really it is very, very rare to have a well fail where things escape the well. You know, one of the problems, and if you look at what a lot of the people who complain about hydraulic fracturing are complaining about, you know, is frequently, well, look at this huge drilling rig, like, you know, almost next door to these houses. And yes, that is unsightly, but the thing about drilling rigs is they're there. They drill the rigs for a couple months and then they're gone. And what is frequently left is a very small wellhead, as in, you know, sometimes that there is like on-site storage tanks. Sometimes they're not, and so you can have actually a very small footprint and something that you wouldn't even recognize as an oil or gas well after the fact. Because, you know, when you drive around and you see, I always get the name wrong, unfortunately, but it's these pump jacks around the country. When you associate those with oil production, you know, pump jacks, a lot of new oil wells are not putting in pump jacks, but they're electric pumps that they're putting in. So those are much smaller, and the impact visually is much smaller. You know, it requires a lot of energy to drill down, you know, frequently, you know, 10,000 feet, and then, you know, horizontally another, you know, 5,000-10,000 feet sometimes. So, you know, there is some air pollution that occurs, but those are all, you know, rather well regulated, and you know, one of the best things about that is that portion of the process only occurs for a couple months, and then it's done, and then you don't have pollution problems afterwards. So, I mean, that's as I view those kind of those issues.
You know, Daniel, it's not like I necessarily rule out the possibility that environmentalists could be telling me the truth about something, or that there are threats out there. But I just recall growing up in the 80s when acid rain was a big issue, and being really stunned to learn when the National Acid Precipitation Assessment Program got underway, and they found that environmentalists had ridiculously exaggerated acid rain. They had misstated the causes of it by and large. They would look at lakes that were naturally acidic, and they'd produce these samples. Or they would look at soil samples where, again, the natural features of that soil would yield you readings like this, and they would trumpet this as the end of civilization. And they would do it again and again and again. And I finally said, I'm tired of being a sucker here. But at the same time, let me just ask you, do you think there is anything environmentalists are saying about this particular case, about this particular combination of technologies that has some merit, or is it entirely fabricated, or is it a misreading of data? What's going on here?
What is not fabricated is that that oil and gas companies need to follow the law. They need to follow the regulations on the books when they drill oil and gas wells, or otherwise you can have wells that fail. And you know, oil and gas companies are like other companies. There are very good ones and some that have you know, made some shortcuts in the past. And so that there have been some problems. Now, luckily, those problems are you know, a very small percentage. But you know, there are some problems that exist. From hydraulic fracturing itself, I think the complaints are completely made up. In that, you know, at this point, after years of having hydraulic fracturing in the news, years after Gasland, there just has not been substantiation to the claims about hydraulic fracturing. Now, when it comes to oil drilling, yes, there are some legitimate issues. You know, the companies need to follow the law. It is very important when you're, you know, drilling an oil and or gas well is not, you know, is not simple. It involves some risk, but you know, I think those risks can be really minimized if they follow the regulations currently on the books.
Now, what I've seen from some of the anti-fracking literature is that they're taking this as an opportunity to remind people of the need to use green energy sources, that this type of technology, they say, is just going to entrench us further in dependency on fossil fuels, whereas instead we could be powering our homes through, you know, wind power and solar and whatever else. What's the truth to that?
Well, the truth is that we don't use oil or gas or coal. I mean, in terms of like we don't use oil or gas to power our transportation. We don't use gas or natural gas or coal to run our electricity grid for much of it, including nuclear and hydro and some other things. You know, we don't do those things willy-nilly. We do them because they work. You know, if we did not have to buy, you know, if you didn't have to buy gasoline, we wouldn't buy gasoline if there was a, you know, currently a more effective way. But the point is with gasoline or diesel is that it's an incredibly efficient system when you look at it as a whole. I could go home, get in my car, and drive anywhere in the country without like having to worry about where am I going to get the energy to do this. And that's a marvel of modern technology. When it comes to electricity, you know, that's where a lot of the talk has been with, you know, switching over to renewables. And one of the most important things about the electricity grid is that supply and demand have to be balanced at all time, or otherwise you'll have brownouts or other problems with the electricity grid. And the problem with that is when they have to be in balance, that they have to be in balance regardless of, you know, whether the sun's shining, whether the wind's blowing. And so you have to have sources of energy that have a switch that you can turn on that will, you know, that will be there for you when you really need it. And while, you know, wind is great, especially like in overnight, in the early mornings is when the wind blows the most, as well as in the kind of the later evening. But when you think of the hottest days of the year, part of the reason that there are, you know, that those days are uncomfortable and generally miserable is because you have that hot, stagnant air. Hot, stagnant air is not that's not what is generating electricity. And so, you know, even if you have windmills, even if you are using windmills a lot to generate electricity, you have to have backup, and that is very expensive because there's no like grid level battery storage. That would be incredibly expensive, and you know there is. You know, we already have, you know, a battery. It's, you know, coal, and it's, you know, coal in the just sitting there in a pile is a battery. You can, you know, put it in a furnace and produce electricity. The same thing with natural gas that is in a storage facility. That is a battery just ready to go. So the problem is that, you know, renewables fail one of the most important things of, particularly with electricity, and that is they, they don't have a switch. They can't, meet demand. And, on those very hot days, you want to have electricity regardless of, how much the wind is blowing.
I read just before talking to you, by the way, I forgot to mention this before, that so-called fracking, it has been banned apparently in Vermont and France and Bulgaria. Now, I don't think of those as the greatest powerhouses in the world, but that's what they've decided to do. Is that the trend, or is the trend toward welcoming the technology? You said this is largely a U.S. phenomenon. Where do you see it going in the future?
Slowly over time, there's going to be more hydraulic fracturing around the world. One of the reasons that France banned it is because France gets the... my personal belief is that, the first part is not my belief. France gets the largest, by far and away, the largest share of their electricity from nuclear. And because of that, and the problem with is when you have lots of low-cost natural gas, you can have, it would create pressure on their current electrical system to use more natural gas and make some of those nuclear plants less cost-effective. That's my take about why France did that. But, other places in Europe want to be more free from Russian natural gas, and those are the ones that are looking at using hydraulic fracturing. So, the trend, I think, is going to be slowly over time as people figure out the regulatory hurdles, because even in the U.S., if you look where hydraulic fracturing is occurring and where it was developed and, where it's had its biggest success stories, places like the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania or the Bakken Shale in North Dakota or the Eagle Ford Shale in Texas, those are all on private lands or a little bit on state lands. And the reason for that is because there the property rights are defined. People, there's a good regulatory environment. It's not happening nearly as much on federal lands, even though there are some places with, there is some that's occurring on federal lands, but the process really got started on private lands. And what that says is there are two things that really matter, is clearly defined property rights as well as a regulatory system that makes sense. And that the problem is around the world, those property rights aren't as clearly defined. There's, you have a lot more government intervention. You have a lot more government rent seeking. And so it's much more difficult. There was a company that Argentina has a lot of shale resources, but once the one company that was drilling down there found that it, cost twice as much to drill a well to try to get the to try to produce oil or gas hydraulic with hydraulic fracturing. And, twice as much, that means it becomes much more, much, much more expensive. And part of that, too, is the U.S. also has the industry. We have all of the oil services companies here. So, slowly things will get better, but it will take a while.
Well, Dan Simmons, I appreciate your time today. This is a topic that, as I say, is a little bit hard for the layman to get his head around when there are competing claims and sometimes vitriolic tone to the argument, and it's hard to assess what's really going on here, and I think you've helped us shed some light on the subject. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
All right, everybody, before I let you go, a couple quick things I want to cover. Of course, instituteforenergyresearch.org is the website you should check out, but I want to mention a couple quick things here. I had an article today, June 9th, over at lewrockwell.com, by popular demand. Like, anytime I get... there's a certain magic number I'm not going to disclose, but a certain magic number of requests, demands, pleadings from people that I write a particular article. Once it passes a certain number of pleadings, I go ahead and write it, even if I don't have the time to do it. And you all know, because you're probably tired by now of hearing me badger you guys about how difficult my life is because of all the work I'm doing for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program. RonPaulHomeschool.com, of course. Check that out. But anyway, I decided, all right, so I'll write an article about Cardinal Maradiaga, the left-wing cardinal who was critical of libertarianism at a recent conference. In a way, he is not critical of all kinds of things that you would think he would be. So I wrote what turned out to be a 2,800-word piece. I was not planning to do that, but I couldn't make it any shorter. That was the shortest I could make it. And I'm very, very pleased with that piece. It's running on LRC today. I was thinking of making a podcast out of just reading it actually, because not everybody will see that article. I can't decide if I should do that or not, or if you guys would think that I was cheating on the podcast by doing that. Like, I don't know. I'll think about doing that. Anyway, I have a book. This is what I want to tell you guys about. I have a book called The Church and the Market. You guys may know about it. I'm not trying to sell you that book right now, although you wouldn't exactly break my heart if you bought it. It's called The Church and the Market, A Catholic Defense of the Free Economy. It really is an introduction to Austrian economics. I think of it as the book between Economics in One Lesson and Human Action. Like, people want to know, what should I read? I don't want to read Mises just yet. What's the intermediate book? And I think this is the book. And some people have not read it because they think, well, I'm not Catholic or I'm not Christian or whatever, so this book wouldn't be interesting to me. That's not really, as people who have read it can tell you, that's not really what the book is about. I'm trying to make the case for Austrian economics to a Christian sympathetic audience, a Catholic sympathetic audience. But apart from some papal references here and there, it really is just a straightforward exposition of all the major topics in Austrian economics, from method all the way up through monopoly, money and banking, prices, wages, etc. All kinds of different things, plus replies to critics and stuff like that. So this book actually won a huge book prize some years ago. It came in first place in the Templeton Enterprise Awards. To my amazement, actually, it never occurred to me that it would be even eligible for an academic prize like that. So that was great. Anyway, I don't keep up with Amazon all that much, but the other day I was linking to this book, and I'm down to a 3-star rating on this book. Not because it's a bad book, by the way. I'm okay with people who have negative reviews, they've assessed the book, and they think there are flaws or whatever. That's fine. I don't attack people like that. Sometimes they're right. Sometimes they've found something that I should have found or whatever. But as you can see for yourselves, by and large, the people, especially the recent people giving it 1-star reviews, obviously have not even read it. I mean, it is ridiculous what they're saying. Well, he doesn't even talk about child labor and all these other features of capitalism. I mean, my gosh, how you could have so little understanding of anything after reading that book amazes me. Of course, that's not a feature of capitalism. That's a feature of reality. But moreover, I do talk about child labor. I do talk about the very things that one of the critics says I don't talk about. So basically what these people are doing is they're reading an article by one of my very hostile critics. And believe it or not, a congenial guy like me has a few hostile critics out there who have written articles about my work on this subject. So they read those articles and they feel like they're qualified to talk about my book, which they've never read. So that's just not fair. I mean, so I'm not saying to you guys, hey, go give me a good review if you liked my book just because I'm getting hit with bad reviews. I'm getting hit with totally unfair reviews. And you'll recall that even though I am no fan of Mark Levin, I have also told people on my blog and in videos, do not go to Levin's pages on Amazon and give him a 1-star review of a book you haven't read. Like, just don't do that. It is really, really hard work to write a book. And you owe the author at least that, at least to read it before you go ahead and do that to him. And these people, as is unfortunately typical of a lot of my critics, refuse to behave in a civilized way. And so, yes, I am actually asking for a favor. For any of you out there who have read The Church and the Market and have profited from it, so to speak, would you please consider writing an offsetting Amazon review? So in other words, I'm not saying I need to have 5-star reviews for all my books, so please just go and fill them with useless reviews. I'm not saying that. I have been unfairly hit with 1-star reviews, and I could really use the assistance of those of you who have enjoyed that book. So again, if you haven't read that book, I'm not saying go write a 5-star review on the basis of how much you like my podcast. If you haven't read the book, don't write a review. But if you have, and I know some of you have, that would really, really help me out. Over the weekend, by the way, I was in contact with Kevin Gutzman, who has been a guest of this program more than once. Kevin is finally now just finishing up the next course for LibertyClassroom.com. It's going to be The American Revolution, the real version. So we will now have 10 courses in history, economics, philosophy, political thought, all to be listened to and enjoyed in your car, plus Q&A forums to ask us anything you want, plus recommended readings to help you navigate all these piles of books, which ones are worthwhile, and so on. You can make yourself an effective debater. You can finally feel like you've mastered a lot of material that you've been wanting to get to, and you can do it painlessly while you're driving, and with 50% off using coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps. So head over to libertyclassroom.com using discount code DISCOUNT in all caps and make yourself happy, make me happy, make Kevin Gutzman happy, make the universe a little bit better. I don't know. I'm making all kinds of outrageous claims here, but make sure and do that. And, of course, subscribe to the program on iTunes or Stitcher. You can do that very easily at TomWoodsRadio.com. That's enough for today. Bob Murphy returns tomorrow. We'll see you.